If you're here, you're probably like me, always trying to find that shortcut to knowledge. Well, good news. Today, we're taking a deep dive into three of Jesus' most powerful statements, those famous I am sayings from the Gospel of John, specifically the first three. And we've got the perfect guide, Dr. Robert A. Peterson and his lecture on Johannine theology. This is going to be good.
It really is fascinating how John structures these statements, often placing them right after Jesus performs some incredible act. It's like the miracle is setting the stage. You know, it's almost like, boom, here's this amazing display of power. And now let me tell you who I am.
It makes you lean in, right? You're like, okay, what are you going to say now? Like with I am the bread of life in John chapter 6, that comes right after the feeding of the 5,000. And Dr. Peterson reminds us that 5,000 was probably just counting the men. So think about that. Probably way more people there, maybe even gathered for Passover. Huge crowd, right?
Yeah, and it's easy to romanticize that miracle, like it was this nice little potluck. But John makes it super clear. This was a supernatural multiplication of food, a straight-up miracle, no way around it. What do you think about that?
Well, it changes the whole feel, doesn't it? I mean, it's not just about feeding hungry people for a day. It's a sign pointing to something much bigger about who Jesus is and what he can do. And the crowd kind of gets it, at least at first. They call him the prophet who is to come into the world, connecting him back to that prophecy in Deuteronomy, the one Moses gave. That wasn't just some random compliment. They were tapping into this deep Jewish hope for the Messiah.
Absolutely. The feeding of the 5,000 was a sign pointing towards Jesus' ultimate purpose, his role in God's plan. But then they ask for another sign, comparing it to the manna in the wilderness. It's almost like they're testing him.
Right. Like, Moses gave us bread every day for 40 years. Top that. This is where the concept of types comes in, right? That certain events in the Old Testament foreshadow later events. Like, you see how the manna, that miraculous bread in the desert, wasn't just about physical survival. It was pointing towards something greater, foreshadowing Jesus as the true bread from heaven.
And what's really interesting is how Jesus corrects their thinking. He reminds them it wasn't Moses who gave them the true bread, but his Father. The manna was temporary, physical. Jesus, the true bread, offers something that lasts forever, eternal life.
But they totally miss the point, don't they? They're still stuck on the physical, free bread forever, sign me up.
It's a classic example of how people in John's gospel misunderstand when Jesus uses everyday things to explain spiritual truths. Like when he says, I am the bread of life, whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. He's not talking about literal hunger. He's talking about a deep soul satisfaction.
Yeah, it makes you think about all the things we chase after in life, things that don't really satisfy. But, you know, this whole idea of Jesus as the bread of life, it caused some controversy later on, right? Dr. Peterson mentions Menno Simons.
Right, Menno Simons, he was a leader in the Anabaptist movement, and he seems to have thought that Jesus had this heavenly flesh. But Calvin countered that, saying that while Jesus is divine, his physical body came from Mary. It was human, just like ours, but without sin. It's a pretty important distinction.
It shows how much weight every word in the Bible can carry and how different people can understand things differently. But even Jesus' original audience had a hard time with this. The Jews, they knew his family, so when he said he came down from heaven, they were like, wait, what?
And this leads to Jesus revealing another important truth. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. This points to the idea that God is the one who takes the first step in our relationship with him.
That's a big question, right? Like, how much is God's choice? How much is ours? But for those who do come to Jesus, the promise is clear. Eternal life, whoever believes has it, and Jesus promises to raise them up on the last day.
Powerful stuff. And then he goes even further, talking about the living bread. The bread he will give as his flesh for the life of the world. That's a direct foreshadowing of his sacrifice on the cross, his death for all of us.
Can you imagine how wild that sounded to them? Talking about eating his flesh. No wonder some people back then accused Christians of being cannibals.
It's a good example of how radical Jesus' teaching was and how easily it could be twisted. And while John doesn't actually describe the Last Supper, there's a clear connection between these words about eating his flesh and drinking his blood and what happens at communion. Some scholars even think John might be intentionally weaving in this deeper meaning without directly describing the event. What are your thoughts on that?
It suggests to me that John's focus is on the meaning behind the ritual, the spiritual reality it points to. But for the people who were actually there, this was a lot to take in. Many of his own disciples walked away. They just couldn't handle it.
It really shows how challenging Jesus' words were. They demanded a response, and not everyone was ready for that. But in the middle of all that, you have Peter's amazing statement. He might not have understood everything, but he knew that Jesus was the key. Lord, to whom shall we go? you have the words of eternal life. It's faith, even when things are confusing.
It's a reminder that faith isn't always about having all the answers, right? So to sum up, I am the bread of life means Jesus is the source of our spiritual nourishment. We get that life by believing in him, trusting in what he did for us. Okay, let's move on to the second I am. I am the light of the world in John chapter 8. Now, before we get into that, there's something we should mention about the story of the woman caught in adultery, right?
Yeah, that's important for understanding the context. You see, that story, while it's a powerful one, the oldest manuscripts we have of John's gospel don't include it. So the verses right before I am the light of the world might have been a little different originally. But the main point, Jesus as light, that's still incredibly powerful.
And he doesn't just say it, he immediately tells you what to do with it. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He's laying out a path, a way to live.
Absolutely. And like with the bread of life, he follows this statement with a sign, healing the blind man in chapter 9. This miracle is a powerful visual representation of Jesus as the light, bringing sight where there was only darkness.
Right. And the disciples, they immediately assumed the guy's blindness was punishment for some sin. They wanted to know who was to blame.
It was a common belief back then that suffering or disability was a direct result of sin. But Jesus sets them straight. He says this happened so that God's work could be seen through him. It's not about blame. It's about God's power being revealed.
It makes you think what looks like a bad situation might actually be an opportunity for God to do something amazing. And the way Jesus heals the man, it's pretty strange, isn't it? Spitting, making mud, telling him to wash in the pool of Siloam. Not exactly your typical doctor visit.
It definitely stands out. But it's a reminder that God often works in ways we wouldn't expect. And you see the man's immediate obedience, trusting Jesus completely. It's a contrast to Naaman, who was initially resistant to Elisha's instructions.
And of course, the Pharisees, they can't let this miracle slide. They question the man, but their main problem, Jesus healed on the Sabbath.
It's ironic, isn't it? They're so focused on following the rules that they miss the miracle standing right in front of them. This leads to some of them actually acknowledging that Jesus must be from God, while others stay opposed.
And Dr. Peterson points out that this back and forth, this division, it's a big part of John's gospel. People constantly having to choose how they'll respond to Jesus.
Exactly. And the Pharisees, they just can't accept it. They even question the guy's parents, trying to prove he wasn't really blind. But the parents, they're afraid of being kicked out of the synagogue, so they basically tell the Pharisees to ask their son.
And the man, he's amazing. He defends Jesus, even using logic against the Pharisees. God doesn't listen to sinners. This guy who is physically blind now sees so clearly spiritually. It's pretty incredible.
It shows how encountering Jesus can change everything, not just physically, but spiritually too. But the Pharisees, they get angry and kick the guy out of the synagogue.
But Jesus, he doesn't abandon him. He goes looking for him.
It's a beautiful picture of how Jesus cares for those who are rejected. He finds the man and asks him if he believes in the Son of Man. And the man is ready. Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?
And when Jesus says, you have seen him, it is he who is speaking to you, the man immediately believes and worships him. Dr. Peterson says this seems different from other times people bowed down to Jesus. This is true worship. He recognizes who Jesus really is.
A truly powerful moment. And this leads into Jesus talking about how he came into the world for judgment.
Which can be confusing, right? Because we know that God sent Jesus to save the world, not condemn it.
Right, that's important. Jesus' main purpose is to offer salvation. But his coming also reveals the truth about people. Those who admit they're spiritually blind and come to him for light, they will see. But those who claim they can see on their own, those who reject him, they'll stay in darkness.
So when the Pharisees say, are we also blind, it's actually giving themselves away.
Exactly. And Jesus' response that their insistence on seeing their own way is what condemns them, it's a hard truth. But it's the truth. They think they're fine, so they don't see their need for him.
So I am the light of the world reveals Jesus as the one who brings true understanding, spiritual sight. It's about humility versus pride. Okay, moving right along, let's head into a sheepfold for our third I am saying. Well, actually a pair of sayings in John chapter 10. I am the door gate of the sheep and I am the good shepherd.
This chapter is full of imagery about the relationship between Jesus and his followers. He starts by contrasting the true shepherd who enters the sheepfold through the door with thieves and robbers who try to sneak in some other way. This seems to be talking about false teachers or leaders who want to take advantage of people.
And he gives some very specific qualities of the true shepherd. He enters through the door. He's recognized by the gatekeeper, and the sheep know his voice and follow him. Dr. Peterson even tells a story about visiting a sheep farm, which really brought this to life. Sheep really do recognize their shepherd's voice.
It's those little real-life details that really help make sense of the imagery, don't they? And when Jesus says, I am the door of the sheep, He's saying he's the only legitimate way to enter God's flock. Dr. Peterson explains that this is about being part of God's people, first in Old Testament Israel and now in the church.
And then there's that statement that could be easily misunderstood. All who came before me were thieves and robbers. But Dr. Peterson explains that this probably isn't talking about the Old Testament prophets, but rather those false messiahs and leaders who were only looking out for themselves.
It's important to understand what he's not saying, right? He's not condemning those who are faithfully pointing to God. And the benefits of entering through the door through Jesus, they're amazing. Being saved, having the freedom to go in and go out, and finding pasture, which is like finding spiritual nourishment.
Now, about that phrase, go in and go out, Dr. Peterson, he's a Calvinist, so he actually addresses how some might misunderstand that as meaning you can lose your salvation.
Yeah, he makes it clear that he's just talking about what sheep normally do. They go in and out of the sheepfold to graze. It's not about losing salvation. And later on in the chapter, he talks about how Jesus gives his sheep eternal life, how they will never perish, and how no one can snatch them out of his hand. So that's pretty clear.
Which leads us right into the second part of this I am in chapter 10. I am the good shepherd. This image also emphasizes how Jesus provides eternal life and takes care of his own.
It's a powerful image. The good shepherd is the one who's willing to die for his sheep. And he contrasts that with the hired hand who runs away when things get dangerous. And the thief, he just wants to steal and kill and destroy. They represent those who lead people astray.
And there's this really personal connection between the good shepherd and his sheep. Jesus says, I know my own and my own know me, and compares that to the connection between himself and the Father. It's like, what does that kind of knowing really mean?
It suggests a deep relationship, and it's God who initiates it. Our source highlights Galatians 4 and how Luther emphasized God's role in starting that relationship. It's a bond built on love and trust.
And it goes beyond just one group of people, doesn't it? He mentions having other sheep that are not of this fold, clearly talking about the Gentiles and showing how the church will one day be united. It shows how big God's plan is.
Exactly. God's salvation is for everyone who will believe. And it's because Jesus was willing to die for us that the Father loves him. It shows Jesus' power and his deity, something we also see in John chapter 2.
And as you might expect, these statements really get people riled up. Some accuse him of being demon-possessed, while others recognize that he's speaking the truth. After all, you can't deny miracles like healing the blind. There's this huge clash going on.
So much tension, and it all comes to a head in the Colonnade of Solomon, where the Jewish leaders finally confront Jesus and demand he tells them straight up if he is the Christ.
And instead of just saying like for no, Jesus points to his actions. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me. But then he says something really challenging. You do not believe because you are not among my sheep. That's a tough one to wrap your head around.
It really is. Dr. Peterson points out that while John emphasizes our responsibility to choose to believe, there are also verses about God choosing people beforehand, those given to the Son by the Father. It's a complex topic, but ultimately, the main message throughout John is that we are called to believe in Jesus.
So we see both God's initiative and our response, but for those who do believe, the promise is so strong. Jesus repeats it. His sheep hear his voice. He knows them. They follow him. He gives them eternal life that no one can take away.
It's the ultimate security. And as we finish up our look at these first three I am sayings, the main point is clear. Jesus is the source of true life. He reveals God to us, and he's the one and only way to the Father.
It's been a really amazing journey exploring these incredibly important statements from John's gospel. So as you go about your day, think about this. How does understanding Jesus as the bread of life, the one who truly satisfies, the light of the world, the one who shows us truth, and the good shepherd, the one who protects and lays down his life, how does that change how you see your own spiritual journey and your relationship with God? Something to really consider. We'll be back soon to dive into the rest of the I am sayings. Thanks for joining us.